Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, we'll hear from the coalition in support of last month's prisoners' strike in Georgia. And it's the first anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti and the 200th anniversary of the biggest slave revolt in the United States.
But first, Carol Moseley Braun is the last major black candidate standing in the race for mayor of Chicago. Ms. Moseley Braun served one term as the first black woman in the U.S. Senate from 1993 to 1999. We spoke with Chicago labor activist James Thindua.
What happened last week in Chicago is that two major African-American candidates, Congressman Danny Davis and State Senator James Meeks stepped out. They basically dropped out of the race, and both of them have given their support to Carol Moseley Braun. She is now really effectively the leading candidate, from the African American community.
This was part of a process to try to achieve just that, to have a single black candidacy.
It's not clear how it happened, but it's strongly rumored that Reverend Jesse Jackson brokered the deal. There was pressure on Congressman Danny Davis, who sits on an important budget committee in Washington, and I think there was just this general sense that right now the president, especially in light of the ascendancy of the Tea Party in Washington, that he needed some strong allies, and that Danny Davis, as an experienced member of Congress, would better serve the Democratic agenda in Washington as a member of Congress than trying to contest a mayoral seat here in Chicago. Quite frankly, James Meeks didn't have a chance. He has made it a habit of offending key Democratic constituencies. He's overtly anti-gay. He has beaten up on the unions. He made a speech in front of the at Rainbow Push a few months ago, in which he attacked the teachers' unions and called them the biggest gang in Chicago. Just another gang. The teachers' union is a gang-banging institution and so forth. And so he really, and of course he is in cahoots with some right-wing elements in the state of Illinois, foundations and others who are pushing a nefarious anti-union, anti-teacher agenda in Springfield. He has become he has come out vocally in support of public school vouchers and has taken a really reactionary position on a really reactionary direction on public education.
Clearly, you're glad he's gone, but what about Carol Moseley Braun's?
Well, I actually have a history personally with Carol Moseley Braun, and I think what I say here reflects the views of many, many activists and many advocates, many progressive advocates, in that when she was in the U.S. Senate, for some reason, she too managed to alienate key Democratic progressive constituencies here in Chicago. A lot of women's organizations that aren't happy with her, a lot of environmental groups, senior citizens organization. I remember an event at a church here in Chicago. It was supposed to be a big legislative event where elected officials, members of Congress, were supposed to come and address senior citizens. There were 700 people who showed up at the Progressive Baptist Church. She didn't show up. She was the only no-show. It upset a lot of senior citizens. I was working at the time as an organizer for Metro Seniors in Action, and she was really supposed to be the marquee guest, and she didn't show up. She sent her chief of staff at the time, Bill James, who showed up and said that the senator was in Washington attending to emergency business and so forth. To make a long story short, we found out later in the day that she was not, in fact, in Washington, that she was en route to London in a corporate jet as a host, as a guest of GlaxoSmithKline at the time. I think that was the name of the drug company that was trying to get her support on a legislation to extend drug patents, and she ended up voting actually the wrong way on that legislation. So there's just a chain of events, issue after issue, where Tara Mosley Braun, for some reason, just managed to offend key progressive constituencies. So it's not clear right now. There appears to be some emerging support. There appears to be some energy, I think, forming around her in the African-American community. But that's only because there really is no other alternative right now. The question at the end of the day is going to be turnout. Can she excite the African-American base sufficiently to actually win the mayoral race in Chicago? I don't know too many people who believe that she can. And when you combine it with the fact that she's running against Miguel Del Valle, who's currently the city clerk, who is Latino and who predicted he was going to get huge support from the Latino community, it's hard to imagine that without a black Latino progressive coalition that Tara Mosley Braun can win the mayoral race. You could argue that Rahm Emanuel, with a sort of the Northeast, the Lakeshore liberal community and white voters, is right now, I think, positioned to win this thing.
And, of course, Rahm Emanuel is no liberal and, in fact, has great contempt for the left.
He has contempt for labor unions. He has used choice words to describe labor unions, especially in Arkansas recently when they challenged Blanche Lincoln and supported Bill Holter, who ran against, who's another Democrat, who challenged Blanche Lincoln in the Democratic primary there for the U.S. Senate. And so he used some choice words to attack the labor unions, and so he has been in the habit of really he's at the center of, and I don't want to get Obama off the hook because he's really also a true believer. But Rahm Emanuel has been has really been a champion of triangulation, and he's actually his set of objective to pushing healthcare reform. He was on the he lost that argument in the White House, but he didn't want the Democrats identified with pushing national healthcare. I don't know why he bothers calling himself a Democrat, quite frankly.
The conventional corporate media wisdom, however, is that because Rahm Emanuel was the right hand man to Barack Obama, he will attract a sizable segment of the black vote.
Well, this is where I think this notion that you know, African-Americans sort of have this blind loyalty, this is going to be a real test. I'm not so sure that support for President Barack Obama necessarily translates into coattails as far down as a mayoral race in Chicago. I doubt that very much. I think people really compartmentalize the celebration of Obama. I think has less to do with issues than sort of the what Obama has represented to the African American community. I think if you break it down to issues, I don't know that there's a real support for the kind of centrist politics that the president is pushing in the White House. So the only way that coattails in this situation could work is if there was a kind of alignment on the issues between what Emanuel is pushing and what the African American communities want in Chicago. Clearly, there's widespread disenchantment with the daily years. People want a break from daily, and I think that African Americans do see Rahm Emanuel as essentially a continuation of the daily legacy of privatization. People are still steaming here in Chicago over the sale of the parking meters, which were sold to a foreign company, a European company, and now parking has just skyrocketed. The cost of parking a car in Chicago has skyrocketed as a result. I mean, so the daily legacy is replete with policy initiatives that are really, I think, for many African Americans, anathema.
And the daily legacy lives on in the son, William, as the new replacement for Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff in the White House.
That's correct. No matter how the spinsters spin this one in Washington and locally, that essentially this guy is an efficient manager who's just going to be herding cats and making sure that the things are running smoothly in the White House and schedules and so forth. He does bring a loyalty to corporate America, especially to finance capital, that really should frighten everybody. The notion that he's not going to have influence on the president president is a pipe dream. The finance industry right now, the banking community is ecstatic. If you look at the commentary, the praise is coming from that side and not from the progressive side. There's a reason for that. I just think that this is the moment. I think as we approach the celebration of Dr. King's birthday here, that we remember that Dr. King really was a person who took seriously his role of being a leader. That he didn't spend a lot of time praising presidents and trying to find to vindicate the records of presidents. And he really saw his role as to speak truth to power. His relationship with Johnson, President Johnson, is instructive. That here was a Democratic president that was facing enormous pressure from the civil rights leader on a whole host of issues in economics, on the war in Vietnam. And so today I'm alarmed by the number of black leadership, community leadership, clergy, political leadership that is seeing its role as first and foremost to defend President Barack Obama against critics rather than push him to do the right thing, push him to stand up and push policies that serve the needs of the poor, the homeless, the most marginalized people in this community group, people ravaged by homelessness crisis, ravaged by the related foreclosure crisis and so forth. And for him to really speak to those issues directly. So I'm disturbed that legacy of Dr. King, of speaking to power, of seeing one's role as to push a progressive agenda rather than defend presidents. You know, the President of the United States is a powerful figure. He's got a powerful apparatus around him. He's a big boy. He's a big man, like we Africans like to say. He knows how to defend himself. He's, the notion that the most marginalized people in society spend their time defending somebody who is so powerful, who knows how to take care of himself, instead of advocating for themselves and pushing for social justice and for jobs and for health care, is disheartening. So I think that we need to get off this sort of vicarious enjoyment that some of us are enjoying at the side of a black first family, no matter how compelling that image is. I think we need to get off of that and really start to work on those issues, on those questions that directly speak to the needs of the people on the ground.
That was James Thindwa, speaking from Chicago.
In Washington, from January 20th through the 22nd, a coalition of organizations will hold a For the People Summit. The event occurs 1 year after the infamous U.S. Supreme Court decision that allowed corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money on political causes. Bill Moyer heads up the Backbone campaign. We asked him who's coming to the For the People Summit.
This is what's interesting about this event, is that as Black Agenda Report, Backbone Campaign, move to amend grassroots progressive folks, we often find ourselves sort of on the outside of collaborations with Beltway-oriented organizations, et cetera. And this is unique in that it's being initiated by grassroots organizations like Backbone Campaign, the Coffee Party USA, Move to Amend, and we're finding great partners in Washington, D.C., ready to go with us, people like People for the American Way, Public Citizen. They're coming on, and we're going to have an amazing 3 days, particularly two really intense days of rallies and press conferences and dialogue and strategy sessions on January 21st and 22nd.
Since the U.S. Supreme Court decision, what kind of impact has it had on the election just this past year?
There are people who are coming to this event. We're going to do a press conference on Friday the 21st after our rally with People for the American Way, who've just done a study on the impacts of Citizens United on the 2010 election. And there'll be folks from Center for Media and Democracy, our mutual ally, Lisa Graves, and other folks speaking to those effects.
Explain to me the concept of corporate personhood.
A lot of us have been aware that this idea that corporations who have been claiming, increasingly claiming the rights of human beings, these inalienable rights that are the foundation of, you know, the rights in our Bill of Rights and the foundations of the Universal Declaration of Rights. They've, since 1886, there is a whole history, a legal history, of establishing and claiming the rights of persons for themselves. Of course, corporations don't die, and of course, you know, corporations are designed to limit liability, but they are now claiming speech, and they're claiming wanting privacy rights, and God only knows, you know, it won't be long probably till they're wanting Second Amendment rights, etc. But it's all rooted in this idea that corporations are somehow persons, legal persons with inalienable rights, and from that, we get this freedom of speech, which is the Citizens United decision was affirming corporations' rights, inalienable rights to freedom of speech.
And in fact, it classified the spending of money as speech.
Exactly. So this money that they spend on favoring or promoting or attacking candidates is all of a sudden, you know, in the public sphere, equated with your and my ability to, you know, protest or to call our congressperson. But of course, in a system that's supposed to be of, for, and by the people, when you make speech relative to wealth, then of course the people with the greatest wealth are going to have the most speech. And of course, and there you cannot have a representative democracy unless what you mean by that is representative of those who are wealthy.
Right. We're not no longer talking about one person, one vote. We're talking about $1, one vote.
Exactly. And in a sense, it's talk about constitutional, you know, fundamentalism. We're going back to where the we the people wasn't the expanded sense of we the people that you and I have over this history of struggles, but it's the original we the people, the white guys, the white wealthy landowners. So it's an erasing of progress, 200 plus years of progress, and it was a gradual thing that this is obviously not out of the blue from the Supreme Court. And in a sense, even though it's an atrocity, it's an outrage, in a sense, this outrage was there already. And the Supreme Court, foolishly and perhaps, gave us something to rally around, because now they've made this very esoteric political issue mainstream.
Bill Moyer of the Backbone Campaign.
In the year 1811, soon after the French sold the Louisiana Territory to the United States, slaves in the New Orleans area rose up in a bloody rebellion. The plan was to capture New Orleans. Louisiana activist Malcolm Suber tells the story.
This year marks the 200th anniversary of the 1811 slave revolt, which commenced January 8, 1811, in St. John Parish, which is upriver from New Orleans. And it was distinguished by being the largest slave revolt in U.S. history. And because of the power of the slaveholders in Louisiana, information about the rebellion was largely suppressed. And when we normally talk about slave revolts, we talk about Denmark Vesey and Gabriel Prosser and Nat Turner. But this was better organized and much more developed. And basically, a brother named Charles Deslon organized over a number of years and planned a revolution similar to what had happened in Haiti. So their aim was to march on the city of New Orleans, which was the capital of the Louisiana Territory at that time. And they were going to capture the city, distribute arms to the slave rebels, and basically declare an independent republic. And this was, of course, 50 years before the Civil War.
Yes, and it occurred not too long after the Haitian Rebellion. I assume it was inspired by that.
A number of the participants were indeed enslaved Africans who had come to New Orleans escaping Haiti with their masters, yes. Not escaping, but coming with their masters who had escaped from Haiti, yes.
Tell us about the demographics of the area at the time of the rebellion.
At the time of the rebellion, especially along the German coast where most of the sugarcane plantations were, the Africans outnumbered the white people probably about 10 to 1. And in the city of New Orleans itself, there was about 50-50. So in the entire territory of Orleans, there was probably about 20,000 Africans and 10,000 white people, probably about 3,000 or 4,000 Creoles.
And how many Africans were involved at the height of the rebellion?
500 men, women, and children marching as an army in brigades down River Road, going from plantation to plantation, bringing out recruits, getting as many arms as they could gather, and marching on the city of New Orleans. Their slogans were freedom or death, and on to New Orleans. They understood quite clearly what their goals were, and they understood quite clearly that if they rebelled, punishment for rebelling was death, and they wanted to be free men and women, so they willingly accepted that sacrifice that had to be made, and that's why we honor them today.
And what repercussions were there after the defeat?
Basically, there was a tribunal that was organized by the slave masters, and they basically found all of the people who they were able to capture, even though they had already killed more than 100. They put 60 of them on trial. They were found guilty of insurrection, and they were taken back to their respective plantations and executed and had their heads cut off, severed. And they were put on pikes that lined the river road between St. John Parish and New Orleans. And that was supposed to be a warning to the Africans not to rebel, but that just redoubled the spirit of those brothers and sisters who were working there. And they had another rebellion the following December.
And you're right, of course. Most of us have heard of Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey and other rebellions, but not about this, even though it was the largest rebellion of slaves in the United States. How was information on the rebellion suppressed?
Well, basically, the slave masters in Orleans and in Louisiana were able to get the cooperating papers not to publish. But information got out anyway, and it was written about in London and in France, mainly through personal letters. But the local newspapers were totally silent about this. In fact, they called it a minor disturbance, even though in the papers of General Wade Hampton and Claiborne and some of the slave masters, they said that this was a very big rebellion and definitely had the possibility of succeeding.
And how many white people died in that rebellion, or was that information suppressed as well?
Well, that's suppressed, but what we have been able to discover that, it, of course, is on the first day of the rebellion when Desmond rebelled on his own plantation, the Woodland Plantation, Colonel Andrew's son was killed. Andrew was wounded with a pickaxe, and we know that several whites were killed along the road, the most famous one being Francois Truffaut, who said that he was not afraid of the slaves, and he basically sat on his front porch with his shotgun, and he yelled at the insurgents that, "Y'all should go back to your plantations," and they, of course, overwhelmed him and hacked him to death.
And what kind of recognition has this event gotten in modern-day New Orleans and the region?
Well, we in the Louisiana Museum of African American History and its predecessor, the African American History Alliance of Louisiana, have been celebrating this event since 1995. In that year also, we published a book written by Albert Thrasher called On to New Orleans. And we were having annual commemorations of the events in the schools of New Orleans since that time. Each year we had an art and essay contest, and there was a resolution passed by the school board recognizing the event. And so it had become quite big before 2005 when, of course, everything was disrupted here with Hurricane Katrina.
That was community activist Malcolm Suber speaking from New Orleans.
The U.S. government claims that the WikiLeaks whistleblowers pose a threat to U.S. interests and even to world order. But Professor Christopher Simpson of American University in Washington says it is governments and corporations that are the real threat, and that they're using the WikiLeaks controversy to perfect their own cyber weapons.
Yes, that's true. State and corporate actors pose a threat to freedom of speech, freedom of information on the Internet.
And how so? How do they do that?
Well, new tactics are being developed to carry out information warfare on the web against whomever they care to target. And the gist of these is a combination that runs from ordinary propaganda on the one hand to denial of service attacks to different types of computer viruses and so on. And we can see these being tested and developed in the campaign against WikiLeaks. To some extent, this is a situation that's not altogether unlike how weapons are developed during other types of war. When there's a conflict, you know that the manufacturers and marketers of conventional weapons want to have their products tested in conventional wars, and they take whatever steps they need to do to get that job done. In an information war, you have the same phenomena of development and testing of new weapons, and that's what's going on right now.
In the case of the attempts to suppress WikiLeaks, you say that up to 500,000 other sites have been endangered.
Yes, that was a particular tactic that involved something that's called a domain name system. And what that has to do is sort of like a giant reference book, if you will, where a name that is typed into a search, or an effort to log on to a particular site, gets transferred to the numeric address of a particular computer that is a server for that site. And that, the use of domain names is fundamental to the Internet. What the attack on the DNS system did was to try to block access to any WikiLeaks information by shutting down access to this index, this domain name, that was connected to WikiLeaks. And this was justified by a claim of, well, you know, WikiLeaks is bad and it's supposedly anti-American, and that therefore the people who are doing this are justified in shutting it down. When they did that, they would be shutting down not just WikiLeaks, but as many as 500,000 other websites. And this is why the domain name system people, the DNS people, kicked WikiLeaks off of their site. So here was a situation where it was sort of where the DNS was being held hostage because they have links to all these other sites in order to cut off people's access to WikiLeaks. It's a very clever tactic. The point for us, well, first of all, there's the specific offense against WikiLeaks, which is a legal organization, and at least as yet has not even been charged with breaking U.S. law, not to mention other countries' laws. So there's a couple of things to draw from this. One is to look at the unequal protection under the law of WikiLeaks, or to say it another way, the double standard, where those who ordinarily, this type of attack on DNS or other places would be investigated by the FBI. The FBI is very aggressive about investigating these kind of attacks when the website under attack is MasterCard or America Online or a major corporate interest. In this case, there's been no evidence, at least so far, that they're following up on this attack on WikiLeaks. And I think especially for African-American audiences, these types of double standards our lesson that has been learned, the damage that this does to people is a lesson that has been learned, a very bitter lesson, and it can't be forgotten. Well, you've got a situation in which the law, for example, in large parts of America for 100 years, it was nominally, it was on the books that you couldn't murder somebody. But as a practical matter, you could murder African Americans and get away with it, especially if they were uppity. There was a double standard. And after long struggle, generations of struggle, finally, the federal government was forced to investigate the murders of African Americans on the same basis of it as everybody else. So we have another situation here of this, of double standards, except it's taking place on the internet, and the difference between who gets protected and doesn't get protected is about politics. It's about who's in favor or what groups are in favor at this particular moment in American politics.
Well, you seem to be raising another kind of specter, an even darker one, that conjures up images of a kind of cyber COINTELPRO program that would target, for political purposes, all kinds of folk on the internet in hopes of taking their sites down.
Well, I think that that's exactly right. And the COINTELPRO, from the standpoint of the FBI, at that particular moment in history, that was a logical, even clever attempt to target their enemies and destroy them, that, from their point of view, is what I'm trying to say. And here, we've got a new media landscape, or at least a different media landscape, and new tactics are emerging in order to do those same types of jobs. So the question is today, is the situation identical to the way it was in the COINTELPRO years? And I think people agree that no, it's not identical. We're in a different time. But there's plenty of lessons that we need to learn from the earlier time. And one of them is this, is that the people who have the money and power to oppose democratic initiatives, to oppose freedom, to oppose justice for particularly the poor, that those people will use these tactics. And they learn from campaigns like the campaign against WikiLeaks how to use these tactics. So what's happening right now, it's not just about WikiLeaks. It's about how powerful interests in society learn about weapons, new weapons, that they can put to use for their own ends. And that's why I say that the campaign against WikiLeaks shows a danger to any organization in any country that uses the web as part of a struggle for freedom and democracy.
Certainly in the United States, much of what calls itself the left is deeply embedded in the cyber world.
Disruption. Sure, sure. Yes, it definitely does. And so everybody today, left, right, center, whatever, everybody today is caught in this contradiction in this paradox where on the one hand, the web or the net is a very powerful tool and can be used to do very constructive things. On the other hand, that very tool carries with it enormous dangers and most particularly potential for types of surveillance that go far beyond anything that the FBI ever dreamed of in the 1960s.
Professor Christopher Simpson speaking from Washington, where he teaches media at American University.
It was 1 year ago that an earthquake devastated Haiti, killing as many as 300,000 people. A recent report shows well over 1 million people living with barely any shelter from the elements, and only 5% of the rubble has been removed in Port-au-Prince. We asked journalist and community activist Ray LaForest which countries have been most helpful to the Haitian people since the earthquake.
Cuba has been there before the coup, before the earthquake. Actually, they've been in Haiti for more than 12 years now. And not only they're the largest contingent, and they were not given credit for it, there was a play for a long time after the earthquake. They were providing the majority of cases, whatever the cholera cases that came, they took care of at least half of them. When the United Nations made a call, an urgent call for additional medical personnel, I believe Cuba added an additional 700. So they, by far, they have the largest contingent in Haiti, and this is done, and something that they've been trying to do with the Haitians for a while, which is not just to provide care like that, but to help develop and strengthen the infrastructure, the medical infrastructure and medical delivery of medical care in the country. Everything has been piecemeal, and hopefully completely fell short of the needs of the Haitian people. So clearly what we need is we need a new Haiti where the Haitian people has a voice, where it gets to choose. We need some of the, for example, the Electoral Council that organized the Provisional Electoral Council that organized the last elections has to be revamped. But not just to get a new one, like some people are saying, but to get popular organization of progressive voices into it so that the needs of the people are reflected, so that parties like the Lavalas Party, the other parties, are not kept from running just because somebody doesn't want to compete with them. And then, of course, they would have to guarantee that the elections are fair. However, personally, and I'm saying that because that's the way things are going to look like they would happen at best, but personally, I have very serious reservation about organizing an election in Haiti under occupation. And I don't believe really that you can have an election, because the purpose of that occupation is to guarantee a certain reality that would be against an election putting revolutionary or at least true forces of change in power in Haiti.
That was community activist and journalist Ray LaForest.
The strike by thousands of inmates across Georgia's vast prison system has been over 4 weeks, but prisoner support groups say retaliations against inmates continue. Last week, the Concerned Coalition to Respect Prisoners' Rights held a press conference at the state capitol in Atlanta. Georgia State NAACP President Edward DeBose presented the coalition statement.
The Concerned Coalition to Respect Prisoners' Rights asserts that the recent brutal beatings by prison guard and 13 squads of Terrence Dean at Macon State Prison and Miguel Jackson at Smith State Prison were carried out in retaliation for the statewide prisoner work stoppage and were not isolated. Formed to support thousands of prisoners, protesters who staged a peaceful strike and protests begun early last December, the coalition was able to secure access for fact-finding delegations to Macon State Prison on December 20th and Smith State Prison on December the 30th, two of nine prisons where prisoners went on strike. It was historic that a delegation of citizens observers were able to investigate the inside of the state prison, including conducting interviews with inmates in the hold. Our preliminary findings point to the need for extensive investigation into abuses of power by prison authorities, absent a rehabilitative program, denial of basic human rights and human needs. We found that prisoners are commonly punished by transfer to extreme isolation cells, where they might remain for months on unfounded charges or pending investigation, and that numerous prisoners are still being held in the hold for participation in the strike. Less than 1% of prisoners have access to any form of education beyond a GED, and virtually no vocational or skilled training is available. Inmates not only cook and clean without being paid, but also they manufacture license plates and perform services for private and public entities without pay, and even cut guards' hair and shine their shoes for free. At the same time, inmates must find the money to pay endless fines and fees for everything from getting an aspirin to being written up in a disciplinary report to holding money in a prison account. Prisoner grievances go unanswered. Thus, they went on strike. Now, the coalition is being inundated with reports of bloody beatings of inmates by guards in retaliation for the strike. The cover-up of the Dean and Smith beatings by the DOC is compelling evidence of systemic abuses and the coalition has made urgent demands to the DOC to open the door of the facility to coalition fact finders, particularly those prisoners involved in the strike. Reveal the whereabouts of the 37 or more prisoners the DOC identified as conspirators. By the way, we call them organizers. Those conspirators that they call conspirators, we call organizers in the strike, who have been transferred to unknown facilities, perhaps out of the state, with report they are being held in isolation without any charge. Set up negotiations with prisoner and coalition representatives to reform and humanize DOC policies in accordance with prisoner demands, including to be paid for their labor, to have greater educational and skills training opportunities, to be afforded decent health care and living conditions, and for justice and parole decisions. Yesterday, the coalition delivered its demand letter to the DOC, the governor, and the governor-elect, requesting a response by early next week. If the DOC is uncooperative, the coalition will rally what is now its vast legal network to exploit all legal avenues of investigation into allegations of DOC human rights violations and pursue all legal remedies. That is the statement of the Concerned Coalition to Respect Prisoner Rights. We think it is a just statement. We think it is a statement and our position that is long overdue for change in the Georgia prison system.
The Concerned Coalition to Respect Prisoners' Rights is comprised of more than 100 organizations. Black Agenda Report's Bruce Dixon spoke to some of the leaders at the press conference.
We're talking to Minister Charles Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, the representative of Brother Sharif, the minister in charge here in Atlanta.
Yes.
And you were part of the fact-finding missions that went into both Macon State and Smith prisons. Without revealing anything that has to be held for the report, what did you see? What can you tell us?
Well, collectively as a coalition, we saw that the request that the inmates had made for proper education, the conditions of the prison, and the food, things of that nature, that they were very valid points. There was one situation where a gentleman had told and made the had said that there had been rat feces in the food. There's situations where rats had actually eaten their way through towels inside the cells. Many of the inmates had talked about the injustices of the parole system as well, too, which many of them just called a joke.
We've heard also that fines are being levied, all kinds of economic sanctions against the prisoners. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, I don't have statistics on that, but there were complaints of many of the inmates about the fines that were levied. For instance, if a family member sent an inmate $50, by the time the inmate actually saw that money, it was down to $15, paying various fees, medical fees and things of that nature, very erroneous fees that were actually went to the prisoners' accounts.
As far as you know, is there any published schedule of all the fines that can be applied to inmates and their funds?
I don't have that information.
So then maybe that will be something that the coalition has to ask for. If there's one lesson that we had to draw from the prison strike and from the response that we're getting from or not getting from major media out here, what would it be?
Well, I would say that we cannot trivialize the actions of these inmates, that the requests, the very valid requests that these men are making, they would benefit everybody. I believe that if these requests are met, then you have somebody who can transition into society and be a productive member of society. If these valid requests are not made, then basically what you are saying is that you want to recycle them back into the prison industrial system. And of course, we know that's big money. So what are you really trying to produce? Are you trying to produce slavery in 2011?
Finally, the prisoners, as we understand, stood together across lines that normally divide them on the inside. What kind of lesson does that have for us on the outside?
Well, we are very proud of the inmates. We're very proud of the inmates by looking past color, racial lines, and other and street organizations. You had the Bloods and the Crips standing hand in hand. I believe it's a lesson for all of us on the outside that all of the problems that humanity has, that they are universal.
All right. Thank you, Minister Charles Muhammad.
Thank you, sir.
We have a coalition that's made up of a numerous group. I'm one of the ones that's a formerly incarcerated person, Pastor Kenneth Glasgow. I'm also Al Sharpton's brother. When you do your research, you find that out. But I did almost 14 years in prison. A lot of different groups got involved because these young brothers and sisters in the Georgia State prisons, they went beyond racial lines, they went beyond religious lines, they went beyond gang affiliation, they went beyond everything that separates us in society and came together as one. I think that we, and I know that we, on the outside in society should use that and do likewise and become unified as they did to stand up for their human rights. We went inside. I was one of the ones that went in with the fact-finding committee into making corrections. We found out that a lot of the allegations that they had made were true. There's a report that will be coming out by the end of the month concerning that. We also found that there were beatings that took place, Miguel Jackson in Smith Prison, as well as Terrence Dean in Macon Prison. So we did a press conference today. We gave a letter to the Department of Corrections yesterday, and the coalition is made up now of over, boy, I think about 3,000 or more have signed on. And it has caught national attention. These type things have happened before. Attica Prison, Lucasville, we had it in Florida when I was in prison myself. But never to this capacity of 9 prisons at one time and thousands of inmates across prison lines. So this is something we need to look at. A lot of people say, well, these are prisons, these are criminals. Well, you know, I question a lot of people when they say, I'm a productive citizen. I got a good job, I got a nice car, and I got a nice house. Well, the Bible says that every seed produces of his own kind. So if you're really a productive citizen, how many productive citizens have you produced? If you're really a good leader, how many leaders have you made leaders? Okay, because the Bible says clearly in Matthew 25:33-46, which is the whole basis of our organization, the Ordinary People Society. I was hungry, you ain't feed me. I was thirsty, you didn't give me water to drink. I was naked, you ain't clothe me. I was sick in prison, and you didn't come visit me. And Jesus said what? Until you have done this unto the least of these, you have done it also unto me. When you have done wrong unto the least of these, you have done also unto me. So we as society need to look at, if we start to help and making those who we consider unproductive and the least of those to be productive, then we create public safety for all society.
Question, Reverend. Some people are saying that this is a reflection of the state's and the nation's policy of mass incarceration, how this is a failed policy. Can you talk about whether mass incarceration is a failed policy or a good idea?
I'm going to be honest with you. It is definitely a failed policy. One of the things that I question is how, you know, any other program that shows failing statistics for each year to year, they will stop putting money into. The drug war is a failing program for the last 30 years that they have pumped so much money into, and it has caused overcrowding in the prisons, mass incarceration. It has caused racial disparities with crack versus powder that we just got passed to 18-1 from 100-1. It has showed bond disparities and all kind of disparities that came up behind the prison industrial complex. One of the things that we have to look at is we got a problem with employment in society. But yet and still, in prison, you got all of these corporations that's putting all of their funds into having the prisoners to produce their and manufacture their items. I mean, so we done took the jobs from the people that are on the outside trying to make it and enslaved the prisoners to do it with no money and not paying them anything, so they won't have to pay the money for the shipping to go overseas. So, yes, it is a failing policy. It's failing for society, but it's definitely not failing for some of those people who are getting the money off it.
Black Agenda Report's Margaret Kimberly tells us what kind of tricks and political theater the Republicans have in store for us.
Republicans who just won control in state legislatures across the country have said that they will not issue birth certificates to children born to undocumented people in this country and deny citizenship to these children. Now, the reality is the states have no say whatever in who is an American citizen. And in the absence of a change in the Constitution, those children are still citizens of this country. But the goal of bringing these cases forward is to energize their base and to bring a solid foundation to Republican Party principles and strengthen themselves for future elections. And it unfortunately does work. So that's one piece of theater, the reading of the Constitution by the new Republican majority, but leaving out things they don't like. Like leaving out any mention of slavery. The original Constitution was a pro-slavery document. But there's a sort of thing that the Republicans do to whip their base into a frenzy, and it does work to effect. In contrast, Democrats cannot stand by anything they do. They made a big deal out of this health care bill. We were told we all should support it. It was better than nothing. And then they ran away from it. They wouldn't defend it in the November election, and inevitably they lost and lost control of Congress. So we have one party that will whip people into a frenzy over the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, for an example, and in fact an interfaith center that would have prayer rooms for Muslims. But no matter, facts be damned, it was used by candidates all over the country outside of New York State who had no say whatever in this controversy in order to get votes. And they did it with success.
Now, if one of the two major parties relies for its success on racist theater, what does that say about the notion of the United States approaching the day of being a non-racial society?
Well, it's clear that it isn't. There are many undercover, and I guess not so undercover, bigots in the country. So it says that that's a lie. The whole notion of a post-racial society is a farcical one, that there are millions of people in this country who can be moved, who can be inspired to take actions or to vote for certain people or certain political parties if they are directed to put white people first. That's what the whole argument about birthright citizenship is about. That is what so many of the Tea Party proposals are about, the whole birther movement. It's about putting white people first. And if someone comes out of the racist closet and promotes white people and their sense of entitlement, then they can get political support. So it says that there are millions of Americans who might not publicly call themselves Tea Partiers, but who are in fact moved by that sort of language.
And for Democrats to pretend that the Republican base is not racist doesn't seem to do them much good, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't do them any good. It doesn't do them any good at all. The Democrats could win by working to help the lives of the majority of working people in this country. Even racist people can be, it's happened in the past, you know, started in 2006 when people across the country were sick of Bush, sick of the Republicans as the economy started to fail. And Republicans won majorities in Congress, and then Barack Obama won keeping those majorities in Congress. Democrats can succeed if they speak to economic needs primarily of the average working person. And they could, the way the Republicans do, they could be steadfast in promoting what is good for the people of this country, but they don't do it because that means they'll be going against the interests of the people who they need to stay in power, financial interests, the corporations. And that keeps them from doing what would help them to succeed politically.
President Obama has just chosen as his chief of staff an executive of J.P. Morgan Chase, that is a representative of Wall Street. What kind of signal is that?
Well, it's just very obvious. It tells us what we've known. I mean, everyone in his cabinet, they all seem to have connections with Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. So it's not surprising at all, but it tells us where political power in this, well, actually tells us who controls the politics in this country. And it's the J.P. Morgan Chases and the Goldman Sachs of the world who, in fact, tell the politicians what to do. And it's really quite obvious with a choice like that. It's not even undercover anymore. You know, it used to be that people could come. They may have been in academia, or they may have been in politics, or they may have done a variety of things. But now it's just take them straight from the corporate boardroom, straight from the seat of finance capital, and there they are at the president's right hand, helping him to move his agenda and to run this country.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio, produced by the same team that brings you blackagendareport.com on the Internet. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.